You're listening to KRBD, Ketchikan. I'm Shauna Carter with the Ketchikan Public Library, and this is Reading the Classics. Today I am finishing up the story On the Gull's Road by Willa Cather. The next day, I began my drawing of Mrs. Ebling. She seemed pleased and a little puzzled when I asked her to sit for me. It occurred to me that she had always been among dull people who took her looks as a matter of course, and that she was not at all sure that she was really beautiful. I can see now her quick, confused look of pleasure. I thought very little about the drawing then, except that the making of it gave me an opportunity to study her face, to look as long as I pleased into her yellow eyes, at the noble lines of her mouth, at her splendid, vigorous hair. "We have a yellow vine at home," I told her. "That is very like your hair. It seems to be growing while one looks at it, and it twines and tangles about itself and throws out little tendrils in the wind."
"Has it any name?"
"We call it love vine." How a little thing could disconcert her. As for me, nothing disconcerted me. I awoke every morning with a sense of speed and joy. At night, I loved to hear the swish of the water rushing by. As fast as the pistons could carry us, as fast as the water could bear us, we were going forward to something delightful, to something together, when Mrs. Ebling told me that she and her husband would be 5 days in the docks in New York and then return to Genoa. I was not disturbed, for I did not believe her. I came and went, and she still sat all day, watching the water. I heard an American lady say that she watched it like one who is going to die, but even that did not frighten me. I somehow felt that she had promised me to live. All those long blue days when I sat beside her talking about Finnmark and the sea, she must have known that I loved her. I sat with my hands idle on my knees and let the tide come up in me. It carried me so swiftly that, across the narrow space of deck between us, it must have swayed her, too, a little. I had no wish to disturb or distress her. If a little, a very little of it, reached her, I was satisfied. If it drew her softly, but drew her, I wanted no more. Sometimes I could see that even the light pressure of my thoughts made her paler. One still evening, after a long talk, she whispered to me, "You must go and walk now, and don't think about me." She had been held too long and too closely in my thoughts, and she begged me to release her for a little while. I went out into the bow and put her far away at the skyline with the faintest star and thought of her gently across the water. When I went back to her, she was asleep. But even in those first days, I had my hours of misery. Why, for instance, should she have been born in Finnmark, and why should Lars Ebling have been her only door of escape? Why should she be silently taking leave of the world at the age when I was just beginning it, having had nothing, nothing of whatever is worthwhile? She never talked about taking leave of things, and yet I somehow felt that she was counting the sunsets. One yellow afternoon, when we were gliding together the shores of Spain and Africa, she spoke of her illness for the first time. I had got some magnolias at Gibraltar, and she wore a bunch of them in her girdle, and the rest lay on her lap. She held the cool leaves against her cheek and fingered the white petals. "I could never," she remarked, "get enough of the flowers of the South. They make me breathless, just as they did at first. Because of them, I should like to live a long while, almost forever." I leaned forward and looked at her. We could live almost forever if we had enough courage. It's of our lives that we die. If we had the courage to change it all, to run away to some blue coast, like that over there, we could live on and on until we were tired. She smiled tolerantly and looked southward through half-shut eyes. I'm afraid I should never have courage enough to go behind that mountain, at least. Look at it. It looks as if it hid horrible things. A sea mist, blown in from the Atlantic, began to mask the impassive African coast, and above the fog, the gray mountain peak took on the angry red of the sunset. It burned sullen and threatening until the dark land drew the night about her and settled back into the sea. We watched it sink, while under us, slowly but ever increasing, we felt the throb of the Atlantic come and go. The thrill of the vast, untamed waters of that lugubrious, passionate sea. I drew Mrs. Ebling's wraps about her and shut the magnolias under her cloak. When I left her, she slipped me one warm, white flower. From the Straits of Gibraltar, we dropped into the abyss, and by morning we were rolling through the trough of sea that drew us down and held us deep, shaking us gently back and forth until the timbers creaked, and then shooting us out on the crest of swelling mountain. The water was bright and blue, but so cold that the breath of it penetrated one's bones, as if the chill of the deep underfathoms of the sea were being loosed upon us. There were not more than a dozen people on the deck that morning, and Mrs. Ebling was sheltered behind the stern, muffled in a sea jacket with drops of moisture upon her long lashes and on her hair. When a shower of icy spray beat back over the deck rail, she took it gleefully. After all, she insisted, this is my own kind of water, the kind I was born in. This is first cousin to the pole waters, and the sea we have left is only a kind of fairy tale. It's like the burnt-out volcanoes. Its day is over. This is the real sea now, where the doings of the world go on. It is not our reality, at any rate, I answered. Oh, yes, it is. These are the waters that carry men to their work, and they will carry you to yours. I sat down and watched her hair grow more alive and iridescent in the moisture. You are pleased to take an attitude, I complained. No, I don't love realities any more than another, but I admit them all the same. And who are you and I to define the realities? Our minds define them clearly enough, yours and mine, everybody's. Those are the lines we never cross. Though we flee from the equator to the pole, I've never really got out of Finnmark. Of course, I shall live and die in a fishing town on the Atlantic Ocean, and the blue seas and the pink islands are as much of a dream as they ever were. All the same, I shall continue to dream them. The Gulf Stream gave us warm blue days again, but pale, like sad memories. The water had faded, and the thin, tepid sunshine made something tighten about one's heart. The stars watched us coldly and seemed always to be asking me what I was going to do. The advancing line on the chart, which at first had been mere foolishness, began to mean something, and the wind from the west brought disturbing fears and forebodings. I slept lightly, and all day I was restless and uncertain, except when I was with Mrs. Ebling. She quieted me as she did little Karen, and soothed me without saying anything, as she had done that evening at Naples when we watched the sunset. It seemed to me that every day her eyes grew more tender and her lips more calm. A kind of fortitude seemed to be gathering about her mouth, and I dreaded it. Yet, when in an involuntary glass I put to her the question that tortured me, Her eyes always met mine steadily, deep and gentle, full of reassurance that I had my word at last, happened almost by accident. On the second night out from the shore, there was the concert for the Sailors' Orphanage, and Mrs. Ebling dressed and went down to dinner for the first time and sat on her husband's right. I was not the only one who was glad to see her. Even the women were pleased. She wore a pale green gown, and she came up out of it regally, white and gold. I was so proud that I blushed when anyone spoke of her. After dinner, she was standing by her deck chair talking to her husband when people began to go below before the concert. She took a long cloak and attempted to put it on. The wind blew the light thing around, and Ebling chatted and smiled his public smile while she struggled with it. Suddenly, his roving eye caught sight of the Chicago girl who was having a similar difficulty with her draperies, and he pranced half the length of the deck to assist her. I had been watching from the rail, and when she was left alone, I threw my cigar away and wrapped Mrs. Ebling up roughly. "Don't go down," I begged. "Stay up here. I want to talk to you." She hesitated a moment and looked at me thoughtfully. Then, with a sigh, she sat down. Everyone hurried down to the saloon, and we were absolutely alone at last, behind the shelter of the stern, with a thick darkness all about us, and a warm east wind rushing over the sea. I was too sore and angry to think. I leaned toward her, holding the arm of her chair with both hands, and began anywhere. "You remember those two blue coasts out of Gibraltar? It shall be either one you choose, if you will come with me. I have not much money, but we shall get on somehow. There has got to be an end of this. We are neither one of us cowards, and this is humiliating, intolerable." She sat, looking down at her hands, and I pulled her chair impatiently toward me. "I felt," she said at last, "that you were going to say something like this. You are sorry for me, and I don't wish to be pitied. You think Ebling neglects me, and you are mistaken. He has had his disappointments, too. He wants children in a gay, hospitable house, and he is tied to a sick woman who cannot get on with people. He has more to complain of than I have, and yet he bears with me. I am grateful to him, and there is no more to be said." "Oh, isn't there?" I cried. "And I..." She laid her hand entreatingly upon my arm. "Ah, you. Don't ask me about that. You..." Her fingers slipped down my coat sleeve to my hand and pressed it. I caught her two hands and held them, telling her I would never let them go. "And you mean to leave me day after tomorrow, to say goodbye to me as you will to the other people on this boat? You meant to cut me adrift like this, with my heart on fire and all my life unspent in me?" She sighed despondently. "I'm willing to suffer, whatever I must suffer." "To have had you," she answered simply. "I was ill and so lonely, and it came so quickly and quietly. Oh, don't begrudge me. Do not leave me in bitterness. I have been wrong. Forgive me." She bowed her head and pressed my fingers entreatingly. A warm tear splashed on my hand. It occurred to me that she bore my anger as she bore little Karen's importunities, as she bore Ebling. What a circle of pettiness she had about her. I fell back in my chair, and my hands dropped at my side. I felt like a creature with its back broken. I asked her what she wished me to do. "Don't ask me," she whispered. "There's nothing that we can do. I thought you knew that. You forget that I am too ill to begin my life over. Even if there were nothing else in the way, that would be enough. And that is what has made it all possible. Our loving each other, I mean. If I were well, we couldn't have had even this much. Don't reproach me. Hasn't it been at all pleasant to you to find me waiting for you every morning? To feel me thinking of you when you went to sleep? Every night I have watched the sea for you as if it were mine and I had made it. And I have listened to the water rushing by you, full of sleep and youth and hope. And everything you had done or said during the day came back to me. And when I went to sleep, it was only to feel you more. You see, there was never anyone else. I have never thought of anyone in the dark but you. She spoke pleadingly, and her voice had sunk so low that I could scarcely hear her. And yet you will do nothing, I groaned. You will dare nothing. You will give me nothing. Don't say that. When I leave you day after tomorrow, I shall have given you all my life. I can't tell you how, but it is true. There is something in each of us that does not belong to the family or to society, not even to ourselves. Sometimes it is given in marriage, and sometimes it is given in love, but oftener it is never given at all. We have nothing to do with giving or withholding it. It is a wild thing, and that sings in us once and flies away and never comes back, and mine has flown to you. When one loves like that, it is enough somehow. The other things can go if they must. That is why I can live without you and die without you. I caught her hands and looked into her eyes that shone warm in the darkness. She shivered and whispered in a tone so different from any that I had heard from her before or afterward. Do you grudge it to me? You are so young and strong, and you have everything before you. I shall have only a little while to want you in, and I could want you forever and not weary. I kissed her hair, her cheeks, her lips, until her head fell forward on my shoulder, and she put my face away with her soft, trembling fingers. She took my hand and held it close to her in both her own. We sat silent, and the moments came and went, bringing us closer and closer, and the wind and water rushed by us, obliterating our tomorrows and all of our yesterdays. The next day, Mrs. Ebling kept to her cabin, and I sat stupidly by her chair until dark, with the rugged little girl to keep me company, and an occasional nod from the engineer. I saw Mrs. Ebling again, only for a few moments, when we were coming into the New York Harbor. She wore a street dress and a hat, and these alone would have made her seem far away from me. She was very pale and looked down when she spoke to me, as if she had been guilty of a wrong toward me. I have never been able to remember that interview without heartache and shame. But then I was too desperate to care about anything. I stood like a wooden post and let her approach me. Let her speak to me, let her leave me. She came up to me as if it were a hard thing to do and held out a little package timidly, and her gloved hand shook as if she were afraid of me. I want to give you something, she said. You will not want it now, so I shall ask you to keep it until you hear from me. You gave me your address a long time ago, when you were making that drawing. Some day I shall write to you and ask you to open this. You must not come to tell me goodbye this morning, but I shall be watching you when you go ashore. Please, don't forget that. I took the little box mechanically and thanked her. I think my eyes must have filled, for she uttered an exclamation of pity, touched my sleeve quickly, and left me. It was one of those strange, low, musical exclamations which meant everything and nothing, like the one that had thrilled me that night at Naples. And it was the last sound I ever heard from her lips. An hour later, I went on shore, one of those overcrowded over the gangplank the moment it was lowered. But the next afternoon, I wandered back to the docks and went on board the Germania. I asked for the engineer, and he came up in his shirt sleeves from the engine room. He was red and disheveled, angry and voluble. His bright eye had a hard glint, and I did not once see his masterful smile. When he heard my inquiry, he became profane. Mrs. Ebling had sailed for Bremen on the Hohenstaufen that morning at 11 o'clock. She had decided to return by the northern route and pay a visit to her father in Finnmark. She was in no condition to travel alone, he said. He evidently smarted under her extravagance. But who, he asked, with a blow of his fist to the rail, could stand between a woman and her whim? She had always been a willful girl, and she had a doting father behind her. When she set her head with a strong wind, there was no holding her, and she ought to have married the Arctic Ocean. I think Ebling was still talking when I walked away. I spent that winter in New York. My consular appointment hung fire. Indeed, I did not pursue it with much enthusiasm, and I had a good many idle hours in which to think of Mrs. Ebling. She had never mentioned the name of her father's village, and somehow I could never quite bring myself to go to the docks when Ebling's boat was in and ask for news of her. More than once, I made up my mind definitely to go to Finnmark and take my chance at finding her. The shipping people would know where Ebling came from, but I never went. I've often wondered why, when my resolve was made and my courage high, when I could almost feel myself approaching her, suddenly everything crumbled under me, and I fell back, as I had done that night when I dropped her hands after telling her only a moment before that I would never let them go. In the twilight of a wet March day, when the gutters were running back outside and the square was liquefying under the crusts of dirty snow, the housekeeper brought me a damp letter which bore a blurred foreign postmark. It was from Niels Nannenstad, who wrote that it was his sad duty to inform me that his daughter, Alexandra Ebling, had died on the second day of February, in the 26th year of her age. Complying with her request, he enclosed a letter which she had written some days before her death. At last, I brought myself to break the seal of the second letter. It read thus: "My friend, you may open now the little package I gave you. May I ask you to keep it? I gave it to you because there is no one else who would care about it in just that way. Ever since I left you, I've been thinking what it would be like to live a lifetime caring and being cared for like that. It was not the life I was meant to live, and yet, in a way, I have been living it ever since I first knew you. Of course, you understand now why I could not go with you. I would have spoiled your life for you. Besides that, I was ill, and I was too proud to give you the shadow of myself. I had much to give you, if you had come earlier. As it was, I was ashamed. Vanity sometimes saves us when nothing else will, and mine saved you. Thank you for everything. I hold this to my heart, where I once held your hand. Alexandra. The dusk had thickened into night long before I got up from my chair and took the little box from its place in my desk drawer. I opened it and lifted out a thick coil cut from where her hair grew thickest and brightest. It was tied firmly at one end, and when it fell over my arm, it curled and clung about my sleeve like a living thing set free. How it gleamed! How it still gleams in the firelight! It was warm and softly scented under my lips, and stirred under my breath like seaweed in the tide. This, and a withered magnolia flower, and two pink seashells, nothing more. And it was all 20 years ago. This concludes On the Goals Road by Willa Cather. You're listening to KRBD Ketchikan.
And now a Reading the Classics Extra. Antinous by Willa Cather. With attributes of gods they sculptured him, Hermes, Osiris, but were never wise to lift the level, frowning brow of him, or dull the mortal misery in his eyes, the scornful weariness of every limb, the dust-begotten doubt that never dies. Antinous, beneath thy lids, though dim, the curling smoke of altars rose to thee, conjuring thee to comfort and content. An emperor sent his galleys wide and far to seek thy healing for thee, yea, and spent honor and treasure and red fruits of war to lift thy heaviness, lest thou shouldst mar the head that was an empire's glory, bent a little, as the heavy poppies are. Did the perfection of thy beauty pain thy limbs to bear it? Did it ache to be as song hath ached in men, or passion vain? Or lay it like some heavy robe on thee? Was thy sick soul drawn from thee like the rain, or drunk up as the dead are drunk each hour to feed the color of some tulip flower? In media vita. Streams of the spring a-singing, winds of the May that blow, birds from the southland winging, buds in the grasses below, clouds that speed hurrying over, and the climbing rose by the wall, singing of bees in the clover, and the dead under all. Lads and their sweethearts lying in the cleft of the windy hill, hearts that are hushed of their sighing, lips that are tender and still, stars in the purple gloaming, flowers that suffuse and fall, twitter of birdmates homing, and the dead under all. Herdsmen abroad with his collie, girls on their way to the fair, young lads a-chasing their folly, parsons a-praying their prayer, children their kites a-flying, grandsires that nod by the wall, mothers soft lullaby sighing, and the dead under all.